Clayton. John Clayton.
Hey, Mom! I'm done with my segment!
This is the Coors Light Cold Hard Facts with John Clayton.
Brought to you by Coors Light. Made to chill.
We are talking football with the professor, John Clayton, as we do every day at this time. And a reminder, you guys can text in any questions you've got for John. Text them into 710-710, the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line. We'll try to get to some of your questions as well. But let's say hello to John Clayton. Hello, John.
Hello,
Clayton.
Guys.
How are you? We've got a big vote coming up on some potential rule changes. And I know Jim is going to try to sway you here in a moment. But before he jumps in and changes your mind, just give me an overview of some of the rules you think will pass and some that you think won't.
Well, usually anything that's recommended by the competition committee passes. And so some limited things as far as the injured reserve list and all that when they go to the 53-man roster. The two big ones are going to be, one, the sky judge, which I'm totally in favor of, and then the other one is an alternative to the onside kick. Instead of having the onside kick, they're not going to eliminate the onside kick, but the onside kick is so unsuccessful the way they've turned things over with the kickoff coverage teams and the kickoffs. So now what you can see is that in 2018, there was only a 4% success rate, and in last year it was 8%, where on a 4th and 15, believe it or not, 12.5% you have a success rate, which still isn't good. And, you know, if you miss it, particularly if you're trailing late in the game, you now give the ball between the 25 and the 35-yard line to the other team that might be winning. But I think that does have a good chance. Sky Judge, unfortunately, the best I think is going to go is maybe to be approved for experimental use in the preseason.
Hey, John, don't you think the allure of the Sky Judge is listening to them talk through it? I feel like a lot of people would understand why they call the penalties that they do if people were able to kind of hear what their rationale is going into it.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that would work. But again, the problem is the competition committee, and there's just not enough support. And I can honestly say I can't envision the NFL allowing that kind of conversation. It worked in the AAF. They televised it in the XFL. That worked well. But unfortunately, the NFL doesn't like that type of open transparency. They want to make sure first they get the calls right if they can, but they don't want any confusion or embarrassment if it doesn't work out.
Okay, John, here are the two rule changes that I'm suggesting that they probably won't even consider, but I think they should, Professor. The one about the ball going through the side of the end zone from the field of play, where they not only give the ball to the defense, but they give the defense a ball on their own 20-yard line. Let's start there, John. That's the most ridiculous rule in the NFL. If you're going to give the ball to the defense, and keep in mind the defense did not recover that ball before it went out of bounds. If a ball goes out of bounds in the field of play, it goes back to the team that last had possession of the ball, and that was the offense. And so you not only get the ball, but you get it at the 20. They should give it to them on the 1-yard line if they're going to give it to the defense. What do you think,
John? Yeah, I agree with that. I think that that is an issue because, I mean, you saw Earl Thomas get burned on a play like that. You've seen over the last couple of years, it seemed like it's in a lot of Ram games that you see that type of a burnage rate. But, I think it should stay with the offense. You know, if you strip the ball out and it goes to the back of the end zone or something like that, sure. I mean, you should get it at the 1-yard line if you're the team that is on defense. But, to give it to the 20, I just think that's too much.
Okay, and the other one, John, is regarding overtime. I just don't think it's fair for the team. If the other team gets a touchdown, if they call heads and it comes up heads, they get the ball, they march down the field, they get a touchdown, game over. In what other sport does that happen? It doesn't happen in the NBA when the other team scores first, the game's over. It doesn't happen in baseball on the top of the 10th inning when the team scores, the visiting team scores. Everyone gets a chance, John. Do you think that'll ever be changed?
No, I don't. I mean, I see the one thing is Philadelphia removed the one on the overtime, you know, because their idea is to try to do something funky at the beginning and have a 15-minute overtime to prevent the ties. But apparently it did not have enough support, and that will not be voted on. But I didn't like the idea of doing the two-possession type of thing, just because if you get it, because ultimately what it comes down to, and I know Dave Wyman will support me on this, is going to come down to a field goal kick. And so what, you know, and if whether it's going to be, you know, at the beginning, if you win the coin toss and get the field goal kick, fine. If you, because again, it's still sudden death. And then, of course, if you go the other way and you come back and you get another field goal by the other team, now 8 of the 10 minutes is gone and you're in a position where you have to scramble to get a quick field goal to win the game. I still think that the fairer thing to do is just go back to the old ways. Sometimes in this league, they change too many rules.
Okay, so I'm going to get a chance. First of all, I was going to give my big raspberry to both of Jim's proposals, because what is the team that wins the in overtime, wins the coin toss,
yeah,
wins what, like 55% of the games or something,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, why is that so unfair? 55%. And so, and here's the other thing. Like, what are these? My mom used to call it grandma's good time rules. When all of the grandkids were little, you know, if something happened, you get a do over. So the offense doesn't take care of the ball and idiotically fumbles it through the end zone, back of the end zone, side of the end zone, whatever. Oh, that's okay. Erase. We'll get a do over here and give the ball back to the offense. What kind of world are we living in?
Yeah, it's a weird world, that's for sure. But that's, again, I think, you know, sometimes...
I feel better now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the one thing is that, and you've seen this over the years, when you played, it was a simpler game. Then they start going in and, you know, adding to the replays and changing things and adding things and then overjudging things. It just becomes too messy. And so that's the thing I always get concerned about. That's why I'm pretty much against... I know... you know, Bob's not in this favor, but it's like limiting any kind of change in addition to replay. You're not going to get it perfect. That's why I think the thing that helps the most is a sky judge, because a sky judge can look at it, take 5 seconds and say, no, that's a bad call. Change it. And, of course, if you have good communication between the referee and the sky judge, that works out well. That was a simple solution, because if you go back to the New Orleans game against the Rams, all you had to do was, you know, the sky judge or then somebody in the league office says, Bill, change the call. And, of course, Bill Vinovich would have changed the call because there's going to be a trust factor. You get the Saints now to get a penalty. They can go up and get the winning score, and that's it.
So, John, just to finish up on the sky judge, what is the logical argument against having the sky judge?
That's one of those changes that they think, one, and particularly in this year. Now, again, I think this year is a kind of, they're using it maybe as an excuse, is that, hey, we can't even get the people into facilities. We don't even know if we can have the ability to negotiate for an eighth official. You know, it's going to be costly, but they can still afford it. But as then, how are you going to get the training all set? I mean, you can do it by Zoom and do it that way. But I just think that in this day and age right now, they may think it's a little bit too complicated.
Sorry, I was way off on that. It's 52.7%,
by
the way.
Wow, you were really wrong.
Oh, boy. Man, that throws that argument out.
Yeah, forget that.
John, as far as players go, we keep talking about quarterbacks that are available out there and none bigger in profile than Cam Newton, yet he doesn't have a team, and a lot of people say, well, it's because there are some medical concerns that you can't check on at this point. And then we see Joe Flacco sign a deal with the Jets after having neck surgery, and he's already come out and said, yeah, I'm not going to be ready for week one physically. He's, you know, we'll get the doctors and a checkup in August and see where it goes from there, but he doesn't expect to even be ready. So how does he get a deal, yet Cam doesn't, if it's just about being able to ensure that they're physically able to play?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's one where they probably fear Cam, you know, coming in there and kind of upstaging the Sam Darnold. That could be one of them. You know, I saw one front office exec unanimously saying, okay, you can see his skill sets decline. I don't know if I buy that. But again, it's the physical is the biggest part. But you're right about this. I mean, they signed Joe Flacco. He just had neck surgery right before the draft. I mean, what was it, April 24th? I mean, he may not be ready for the start of the regular season. They just feel, and you know, Joe Douglas, I guess this is where familiarity helps out, because Joe Douglas did work in Baltimore for several years. And so he was there with Flacco. And I think that he felt that Flacco could be a good influence and maybe a teacher to their quarterback, who's, you know, Sam Darnold, who, you know, they want to grow. And so I think, you know, the fact that they knew him is probably the main reason, because, you know, Joe doesn't know Cam Newton.
Hey, John, Greg Olson getting some shout-out from Steve Smith. They were teammates in Carolina from 2011 to 13, but he basically was saying that Greg Olson's like having another quarterback out on the field. And, you know, maybe, I don't know, I guess I thought, well, I think he'll do okay, but, man, you know, listening to him saying, hey, I'm taking this thing for real, it's serious, and I feel like I can be just as productive as I've been in any one of my previous years. So I don't know, man. I feel like I've been looking at that acquisition as just kind of an afterthought, but could end up being a really good pickup for the Seahawks
based on what everybody's
saying about him.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, it's interesting because two of the debates that I think are going to be there strategically, should this team be a three linebacker based defense or should they mix in a little bit more nickel? And I think there's going to be an interesting debate, you know, should this team use more two tight end with Olsen, Disley, or if it's going to be Hollister, you know, those two, you know, than they did last year. I think they had maybe 262 plays with two tight end, and they were like the fifth most active team in using three receivers. And so you kind of wonder with, you know, a lot of teams, particularly now moving into a few more two tight end sets, you know, the advantage, because you get a blocking advantage out of it. You know, you may, particularly if they're good pass catchers like Olsen and that, I mean, you get some good plays against zones that you can kind of sneak behind a zone and make a good play or in the middle of the field. So yeah, I think that's going to be an interesting thing, but you know, good for Steve to be able to call out a real good tight end in Greg Olsen.
John, what about Rashad Penny when he comes back? We're all led to believe, especially with the Carlos Hyde signing, that he's going to be on the PUP list. He'll be ineligible for the first six games. So what do you think? I mean, do you think he's just going to be good to go week seven when he returns? Or don't you think there's going to be some ramping up there and that Hyde could be the backup the rest of the year, perhaps?
Could be, yeah. I mean, because, again, it's tough coming off an ACL, particularly if you're a runner. I mean, you know, others have done it. It's hard to say that he won't be able to do it because, again, you know, he's going to work hard at it. And, you know, he's got the chance to at least, you know, come back. I don't think anybody knows for sure. I just think that, you know, with the timing of the injury, the likelihood of him being there for the first six games, not very good. But, yeah, he's going to need some time to try to catch up, you know, once he gets back and starting to run. Because, again, it's not like he, like everybody else, has had an off-season program. And, of course, he can't have an off-season program. All I know is that he's rehabbing real well, and I think he's a little bit ahead of schedule.
Again, you can text in any questions you've got for the professor to 710-710, the Busy Hard Seltzer text line. We'll try to get to some of those coming up here. But, John, I saw that Vince McMahon said he is not going to try to buy back the XFL. So I'm wondering what that means to the future of it. I think some people looked at that as potential hope of the league surviving. We heard they were talking to different cities, Seattle being one of them, about securing stadiums and things moving forward. So what do we know about the future of it if he is not part of the bidding process?
Well, I mean, I think what he did, and of course, he was caught on this one because what he tried to do, because he said he lost $200 million in court documents that have been filed, and losing the $200 million put him in a position where he's got a lot of debtors. And so what happened is that they looked at the case and they said, oh, you want to try to buy this? My read on it, and this is the court, is that you're trying to do this to avoid paying off anybody. So in other words, you buy the league and you just not pay a single soul, as opposed to negotiate with all the debtors and trying to get some kind of a solution. So he was caught on that, and being caught on it, I guess he basically said, okay, fine, I can't bid on it, but it's still debatable if anybody else is. You start to hear some rumblings because, again, like anything else, everything is deadline-oriented and everything is cost-based, and so there may be some bidders. I still think it's going to be very difficult, particularly not knowing if college football is going to be there this fall or in the spring or back, you know, after the Super Bowl next year. So I'd say right now the odds of it aren't good, but maybe he can get something out of it in some kind of a sale.
All right, Professor, we're going to talk a little bit about this in the next segment, but did you get a chance to watch any of the golf or any of the highlights or anything with Brady and Manning?
Yeah, I did. I thought it was good.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah, I thought Tom Brady came off really well. And, I guess here in Seattle, maybe, I don't know about nationally, I feel like, you know, some people love him, some people hate him. I've always loved him just because of where he came from, being a late-round draft choice. And I thought he came out kind of relatable in that because he's kind of a hacker like the rest of us.
I mean, honestly, it was kind of like the last time I golfed. It's like, hey, he puts the shots in the same place I put them. You know, not in the middle of the fairway, over on the side where you have to go and see if you can find the ball. And it's like, I mean, here's Tom Brady, you know, the quarterback, you know, is the greatest quarterback ever, and you could really find, hard to find where the ball was after he would hit it, which I thought was very unusual. So I thought that was a kind of great thing to show. And, of course, I like the fact that, you know, he jumps into Barkley's face after he, you know, holds the shot and gets the eagle and all that stuff, and then he's picking up the ball and his pants rip. I mean, how wild was that?
Yeah, and he had to wear rain pants or whatever for the rest of the round.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I thought that was pretty hysterical. But, no, I thought that that was a great event. The fact that it raised $20 million was great. I thought Peyton Manning, you know, was the star because he was funny. He golfed pretty well. I thought that, yeah, it's like you got the typical beginning of the round choked by Mickelson. I love the one hit where, you know, he's trying to chip up on the green and he missed the shot and basically it went like about 3 inches. It's like it was hysterical to see. I mean, he turned it around and finished well, but it kind of went the way I thought, but sure, it turned out to be pretty close at the end.
No, it was a fun event, John. And well,
by the way, on the golf show, how did you preview it?
Oh, we previewed it, John. We mastered every single detail. We touched on it with Sean Crew. And we're going to be back again after your show this coming Saturday, John, 9 o'clock, another looking golf show following the John Clayton Show.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah. Okay, Professor, speaking of Tampa Bay and Tom Brady, so he goes down there with the Buccaneers. BetOnlineAG.com, or it's BetOnline.AG. I think it's one of those things, Professor. Yeah. Anyway, they've got odds out on Coach of the Year. Bruce Arians and Bill Belichick are co-favorites. If you had to pick one or the other to be Coach of the Year, which one would you choose?
I'd choose Arians because I actually think they're going to win more games than the Patriots. And, you know, I think that the Patriots are going to struggle to make a wild card at best. And I think the Bucs have now put themselves in a position to challenge for a wild card. And, I mean, you look and you see, okay, they've got Brady in an 8-win season last year. You know, giving them Brady could get them up to 10, where you look at the Patriots and it's like you can't be rewarded as that great of a coach. As, again, he's a great coach, but I just don't see him have the talent to do better than 8 games.
John, a couple of thoughts from the texters here. The 206 says, tell Clayton the real reason for Cam not coming back is because the dry cleaners are closed due to the virus and he can't make his appearance without having on his purple and pink suit with a paisley scarf. So that's why he's not coming back.
I think
back,
you probably
apparently
nailed it. Yeah. So yeah, because that's the thing. It's like, I mean, he can't even get into a lot of stores probably because you know it has to be a curbside pickup, and you can't go in there and try your suit on with curbside pickup because if you do that and you're doing it on the outside, you could get yourself in trouble.
Yeah, and then one more. 509 says, how badly does Clayton want Antonio Brown to join the Seahawks? And I don't know if you have a rooting interest in his future, but it was a topic with Tom, Jake, and Stacy today. How realistic is this in the end, do you think?
I don't think it's very realistic at all. I give it a 5% chance. And again, everybody kind of overreacted to it, which I guess is because, you know, there's nothing else going on for the most part in any little piece of football news. And again, this is something that if anything would happen, you're talking about July or August. Before then, I think Josh Gordon is going to become available. And if that's going to be the case, I think you'll end up signing with the Seahawks and there's no other room for a wide receiver. Certainly, you know that Antonio Brown's the best receiver on the street. But again, you know, what's his price? Is he going to come in and have to be on the exempt list? There's too many complications in it. I mean, this one, 5% chance of happening. I wouldn't eliminate it, but this is not going to happen.
Dave?
Hey, sorry, Professor, I cut out there, John, really quick. I'm sorry, Jim. John, do you have any idea how many XFL players have signed, and what do you expect as far as, you know, those guys having kind of a shortened season? But it seems like there were some good players here with the Dragons, mm-hmm. and what's sort of the expectation as far as those guys?
By my count, there's about 27 that have signed, and the Pittsburgh ended up signing 9 in lieu of signing undrafted free agents because they felt that, you know, those guys will be able to integrate quicker than the undrafted free agents. And so they signed almost as many XFL guys as any of the undrafted guys. And so about 27 total. Tennessee was able to grab some. And I think, you know, Philip Walker clearly is the best to come in because he's going to be battling for a backup job with the Carolina Panthers. So I think that could work out real well. But, yeah, I think they're going to have a little bit of an edge because, I mean, you look at the 428 undrafted guys and, you know, they've had no offseason program. They got signing bonuses and all that stuff, but you know, you don't know how good they can be and how fast they can pick it up with the limited amount of time they can be on the field. So I was surprised maybe there was not more signings of XFL guys.
Professor, we all know about Super Bowl hangovers for the team that loses the year before. What about the Niners this year? Do you think they'll battle their way through it, or do you think they'll be a victim of that hangover?
They'll be a victim, but it's not going to be as bad as, say, you know, Carolina when they had the 15-1 season with the easy schedule, came back the next year and was 6-10. You know, it's not going to be like the Rams, who I think, you know, are going to come back and not make the playoffs. I mean, they're too good of a defense. You know, because I know that they're not as good without DeForest Buckner. You know, they haven't really fixed up some things in the secondary on the other side of Richard Sherman. That's still a little bit of a void. But I think it's too good of a team. I think their drop-off is going to be from 13 to 11 or 13 to 10, which, you know, that's, and if it's, and Seattle, if they can just do well, they can maybe catch the 49ers.
John, we talked to a guy from Houston on Friday about Carlos Hyde, and you know, he apparently, according to him, was offered a $10 million deal, $10 million over 2 years from the Texans, turned that down, shows up here in Seattle. He's going to make less than that, even if he reaches every incentive, obviously. So he clearly overplayed his hand, and I'm wondering where Devontae Freeman is in that, what he's expecting to be paid, and what do you think he's actually going to get paid?
Yeah, knowing for sure, my guess is he's probably trying to hold out for six, maybe six and a half. I mean, he was replaced by Todd Gurley, who got 5.5, but that's just not the market right now. You know, the market's 2 or 3 at best, and so we'll see if Hyde's deal is going to be 2 or 3. But, you know, I still think that, you know, Freeman has misguided himself in the market, and then you have to wonder, how much does he really want to play? You know, he let it leak out at first that he might sit out the season if he can't get what he was going to do and what he wanted for money, and then he turned into he's thinking about retirement, which turned out not to be true. But I think in the end, you know, he's got to figure out exactly which way he wants to go, because unfortunately he's in a bad spot right now because, you know, no team and no money.
John, as always, we appreciate it. We'll talk again tomorrow.
All right, sounds good.
There you go, the professor with us every day. If you missed any of today's cold hard facts, brought to you by Coors Light, made to chill, just download the podcast at 710sports.com. Coming up, the Match charity golf event was this weekend. It set records in terms of viewers. It was entertaining. I thought it was awesome. We're going to discuss some of the highlights. You guys can weigh in as well on the text line, 710-710 to the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line. All of that coming up with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and Moore.
Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
A reminder, you guys have radios in your homes. If you've got a smart speaker, regardless of what, whether it's Alexa, Google, what have you, just tell your smart speaker to play 710 ESPN Seattle or 710 AM, and there you go. You've got a radio right there. Coming up in less than 15 minutes... the word is Danny O'Neill tried to throw our very own Dave Wyman under the bus with his old teammate Terrell Davis today. We'll let you hear what that's all about. So stay tuned for that. And then obviously the 5 o'clock hour begins with the one, the only El Hombre, Michael Bradley. But over the weekend, we had the Match, the charity golf event that featured Tiger Woods, Phil Mickelson, Tom Brady, and Peyton Manning. And I was looking forward to this, guys, before, you know, I was like, all right, this will be pretty cool. Let's see what it's all about. And didn't have huge expectations, just something that was live and happening. It exceeded everything. I thought it was awesome. I honestly couldn't point to anything that I didn't like in it. I thought the interaction between the players was fantastic. Hearing the expertise, especially from Phil, reading the greens and talking to Tom Brady and giving him advice about the color change and this, you know, it's laying this way and you see the color change in the green here. It means it's going this way. And just, you know, that communication and Peyton Manning, it's just hilarious. I mean, I'm an unabashed fan of Peyton Manning, and that just grew over the weekend. I thought he was great. Charles Barkley was awesome. Literally the only thing that you could point to, in my opinion, that I thought could have been better was the weather outside. And even that was sort of interesting to see them battle through it. I thought the whole event was awesome. I watched every moment of it, and it's the highest rated golf event on cable in history. Most watched golf event in the history of cable. So that tells you, A, how appealing these four are, and B, how starved people are for just a live event, and maybe C, just how good it was, how well it played.
Well, let me ask you, Jim, how do you think it would have ranked if we had other sports going and, you know, they just decided to throw that in? I mean, obviously it wouldn't be the highest ranked probably, but would it have been that popular, you think?
No, I don't think so, Dave, but I think people would have watched just because of Tom Brady being there with Peyton Manning, and anytime Tiger Woods is teeing it up, Tiger Woods hadn't played since February, but, you know, I hadn't really thought about that, but you're right. I think if we had a Mariner game going on, all the different baseball games, if there was, and maybe there was a NASCAR event, I just didn't realize it, but if it was a typical Sunday afternoon, I don't think you would have gotten whatever it was, 5.8 million viewers. Is that what you were saying, Bob?
It more
viewers than The Last Dance did. And I thought it was just, I'm hoping that golf can take something from this exhibition, because I'm with you, Bob. I left the yard. I was working in the yard and I thought, well, I'll just go watch for a half an hour. And 4.5 hours later, I was still sitting there watching it. So it was just, It didn't lack in anything. Justin Thomas was great, giving Barkley a hard time, you know, wondering if his fat rear end could still dunk a ball. And it just had a little bit of everything for everybody.
Yeah, I don't. Dave, did you catch much of it?
Yeah, I saw a good amount of it. I mean, enough to just kind of know. I knew Peyton Manning was funny. I've been kind of promoting this Peyton Places thing because he's just so good at interacting with people, and it's just not even his jokes so much as it is just the timing and the way that he does it. He comes off as very self-effacing. And then the other thing I thought was kind of charming was Tom Brady. He was calling everybody big guy. Hey, nice shot, big guy. You know, he just – I mean, I was fortunate enough to see the one part live where, because I taped it and kind of watched, went through it a little bit, but the part where he chips it in from like, what, 120 yards away or something, and then he's like, all right, I have the floor, now I'm going to talk, and he starts talking about his wife and kids and how much he loves his wife and everything. I just thought that was awesome. How can you not like Tom Brady? I mean, come on. You know, the guy, other than he beat the Seahawks in the Super Bowl, but, you know, for the most part, you know, he's, I know that there's the ball inflation thing that just was ridiculous.
Deflategate.
In the first place. Yeah, but, you know, other than that, I mean, the guy's an underdog, and now he's, you know, and I guess nobody sees him that way anymore, but, you know, because he's married to a supermodel and has millions and millions of dollars and all this popularity and all these Super Bowl trophies and everything. But, yeah, I just have always, I've tried to hate him because a lot of times, you know, quarterbacks can be kind of clowns a little bit. And a lot of times when, you know, there's too many of them analyzing football, it sort of irritates me. But, yeah, I just have always liked him and always thought that he was just a pretty genuine guy, and I thought you saw that.
Yeah, there was. I thought it was just a great showcase for their personalities, and you know, you talk about that shot, and Jim, I don't know how far away Brady was, but up until the seventh, Brady was, he looked like a hacker. I mean, he still looked better than I've ever played, but compared to the other three, he was really struggling, and I think it was right on the heels of Charles Barkley giving him a hard time, and then he hits that miraculous shot, cut number 10. Here's Brady.
What do you got left here, Tom?
His third.
I think you just made him mad, Chuck.
Oh, no. I love it, though, man. He can take a joke.
Oh, go in!
Oh,
my goodness!
You made it!
Wow!
Take a second. Hey. Shut your mouth, Chuck. Man. Take a little of that medicine. Get your butt out of here. I haven't hit a good shot in 8 holes, so I'd like to speak for a little bit. Everyone get comfortable.
Yes, yes. The
Mom
floor is yours.
Thank you very much.
The floor is yours.
That was a brilliant shot, man. That was one heck of a shot on a day, again, where he was really having a rough go of it there for a while. And then we saw, you know, a couple of pop-ins. J.J. Watt was on there. And then Russell Wilson, you know, joins the broadcast for a little bit and, you know, doing a cool thing. He was donating 100,000 meals for each player that came within 12 feet of the hole on the 16th. And three of them did it. The only one that didn't come within 12 feet was Tiger Woods. But here's cut number 11 of Russell Wilson.
I'm doing great, man. I love this competition. You know, I want to sweeten this pot, though, you know, just to lead it off. You know, I love competition. So I'm going to go with whoever's 12 feet from the hole. If whoever's closest to the hole, okay, 12 feet, within 12 feet, I'll give 100,000 meals for each one. I'm going to sweeten this pot a little bit with Feeding American Meals Up and what we've been doing with Wheels Up. So let's partner it up here. Let's have some fun.
Good job, Russell. That's awesome. Appreciate you, man. And we're going to give it a look here. Perfect timing.
Right at it. Good looking shot right there.
Yes, sir, is it ever. Wow.
That's 100,000. That's 100,000 meals right there, Brady.
Yeah.
Kick left.
Nice.
Come on. Come on.
Oh.
Come on.
Oh. Just checked up.
Oh. That's another 100,000 meals. I like it, fellas.
That action.
Great shot.
Right at it, too.
That may be it.
My goodness.
Oh, man.
Wow. Add another one to the mix.
We got 300,000 meals.
Wow.
So there you go. The one guy that didn't get within 12 feet of the hole was Tiger Woods, who had a great day. By the way, I think he hit every fairway, if I'm not mistaken. Jim, you can correct me. But just a cool, beyond cool gesture by Russell Wilson, and he was having fun with it on Twitter, saying, hey, you know, when Brady was struggling, saying, hey, maybe it should be, you know, me and Sierra versus Tom and Giselle, and we'll do it in Mexico or do it in another location. But kind of, you know, having fun, talking a little smack on Twitter, and then to come on and ultimately donate 300,000 meals to, you know, Feeding America. That's outstanding.
Well, yeah, it was really cool, Bob. And when he offered that up, I thought, well, wait a minute. This hole's 181 yards. The rain is pelting down. I didn't think anybody would get within 12 feet in those conditions. And then to have three players get within 12 feet. Peyton Manning almost holed it. I mean, I think he was a foot or two away, and Brady was 3 feet away or something like that. And then Mickelson 5 feet away. So that was really cool seeing that. And I felt for Tom Brady. You guys know how I'm always ripping on Tom Brady. Oh, he's 43. He's not going to be the guy he was there in Tampa that he was in New England. But, boy, those first six or seven holes, you put yourself in his golf shoes, and we've all been there and at different levels of play, certainly, and not in that much pressure. But, you know, and Moyer and I were going back and forth on Twitter, and clearly to me, he was nervous. He's an 8 handicapper, which suggests he hit some shots that he probably hasn't hit in years. And it was nerves. And then Paul was like, well, how could he be nervous? He's played in the Super Bowl. And I'm thinking, well, because he's a human being. He's playing golf. He's not playing football today. Can you imagine being in his shoes? And Peyton Manning, he handled it fine. He just kind of stepped up and hit his shots. Peyton Manning will never be accused of being a slow player, that's for sure.
No. He took very little time with all of his shots.
Yeah, but it was just – it was nice to see Tom Brady figure it out, because it's hard to figure out during the round what's going on with your swing. And there's some theories out there, and I subscribe to this theory. I'll bet you he had a couple of pops at the turn. He must have done something. I bet he had an alcoholic beverage or two, because he seemed to loosen up after that.
Yeah, maybe the nerves wore off. But for those that watched it, I tweeted out that I'm not even a golf fan. I mean, I was when Tiger was in his heyday. I really followed it, but I don't follow it really at all anymore, and I'm really indifferent. And I walked away from that going, that was awesome. I loved every single moment of that event. So well done to all those guys. Plus, on top of it, they raised $20 million. $20 million for COVID relief. So that's just all in all just a huge win. All right, coming up, Danny O'Neill tried to throw Dave under the bus, apparently with his old teammate Terrell Davis. We'll hear more about that when we sweep the dial with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Sweeping the dial. Streaming everywhere on the 710 Seattle Sports app and 710sports.com.
Terrell, we're really thankful for you joining. The one last thing I wanted to provide to you, you remember Dave Wyman, who was your teammate?
Of course, I know Dave is doing, if they're doing play-by-play, doing color, what's the play-by-play work for you? I know color.
He's doing the color for the radio broadcast. He works at our station, and you might be, I mean, Dave's always been one of the bigger, tougher guys I know in a locker room. It turns out he's a big, giant weenie when it comes to onions. Like big, tough Dave Wyman.
Onions?
And all of a sudden, if you put onions on his food, he starts crying and complaining and threatening to go back and yell at the Burger King employee who put the onions on his burger. It's actually kind of pathetic.
You know what? I understand that. That's like when I go I go to a fast food place and they put mayonnaise on my chicken sandwich.
Oh, yeah.
And I go nuts. I can't stand mayonnaise.
Same, buddy.
I'll tell you what, I am with Terrell Davis on mayonnaise. It is repugnant, it is gross, it's disgusting, and I would react the exact same way. But, Dave, it seems like Danny's just got, he keeps hitting that button. He really loves the whole onions thing with you.
Well, it's clear who's the better teammate to me, Terrell Davis, of course. But, yeah, I mean, he went on and on. Again, it's Danny's quest to try to make me weaker somehow, but it's not working for him. So, yeah, my dad, you'll like this, Bob. My dad used to have peanut butter, mayonnaise, and banana sandwiches. Is that disgusting?
Oh, man, that just makes my jaws tight.
I guess that makes you a huge wussy, Bob.
I'll own it then. If that's the definition, then fine. I'll be that.
When was the last time you had mayo, Bob?
I couldn't even tell you. It was by accident. It was probably put on something by mistake that I didn't check. But I have not intentionally eaten mayonnaise since I was a little kid.
And they called me to ask me to play. Rob couldn't call. I said, Rob, I love to play. And I did Thomas with you. He assured me. He said, you know what? Chuck that one, Isaiah. So Isaiah's not going to be a part of the team.
Uh-oh. That's audio of Michael Jordan talking about him saying he did not want to play on that dream team with Isaiah Thomas. And then anybody who watched The Last Dance, he's like, I didn't say that. I never said that. Well, there you go. There's audio of it. So that doesn't play well.
Well, I think everybody's kind of going after Michael Jordan right now because he had his shot to take it, everybody, like Horace Grant and Bill Laimbeer and all of those guys. And so now everybody's like, that's not the version of history that I remember. So everybody's getting their chance to kind of fight back here. And I don't blame them, honestly. I mean, if there was some thing, you know, let's say it was like a Boz deal and he talked about how I was not a good friend and things like that, I wouldn't be very happy about that because that wasn't the truth. But yeah, that's only, I mean, to me, it's kind of adding to the whole Last Dance thing. I've learned to sort of just embrace the bitter Michael Jordan. You know, and I went back and watched his Hall of Fame speech where he was talking about all the people that passed him up and even his roommate in college. He was supposed to be the best player, the best prospect, and apparently they were wrong about that. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And so, yeah, I think it's kind of funny. It adds to it. It doesn't make me like Michael Jordan any less.
No, it's just, and everything was released with his consent, with Michael Jordan's consent. So I guess it's to be expected that it's going to be his version of how things played out. But clearly, no love lost there with Isaiah Thomas. Those two guys, they're going to carry their bitterness to the grave, I think.
If I was competing today, I could tell you who my peers would be. Right? My peers would be Michael Phelps, LeBron James. And so I see where they are. And so only now do I realize, okay, that's where you were. That's where I was. I really don't miss that. And I think if I'd have stayed there, it wouldn't have been good for me.
The voice of Lance Armstrong from the latest ESPN 30 for 30, part one of the two-part series on him. I thought it was really well done, the first one. I enjoyed it. He does not come off as very likable at all. When you see what his attitude was as a teenager up until, you know, to the part where they cut off, I mean, he's not a likable guy. Yeah, I don't know what else to say. I'll be curious to see how they address it in the second part, but I think there was some concern that this was going to be some sort of image rehab for him, that they were going to cater to him in order to make him look more presentable and more sympathetic or what have you. And I would say the first part did nothing of the sort. We'll see what happens in part two, but I enjoyed part one.
Yeah, I'm going to have to start watching that because I just think, you know, even though, I mean, I'm much more interested in in basketball than I am cycling, although I rode my bike like crazy, you know, when I was rehabilitating for my, you know, my knee injury and everything. I wasn't really super into it, but he's one of those characters that I think he's going to be like Michael Jordan. Like, it's kind of fascinating to see some of the sacrifices you have to make in order to be great. Like for Jordan, I mean, I don't think there's a lot of people that would say he was a good teammate. I mean, he's telling the flight attendant that Horace Grant can't have his food because he didn't play well enough. I mean, I just feel like there's a certain amount of like a trade-off that you have to be the best, and a lot of it is you're not going to come off as the nicest guy in the world.
No, he certainly doesn't come across that way, but he seems like he's being honest to me. It sounds crazy to say that about a guy who was lying for years, but it looks to me like he's trying to come clean. I really enjoyed part one of the Lance Armstrong documentary. I just sat there and I thought, well, I'll watch it because we're probably going to be talking about it on the show. But then I got more and more engrossed in it, and I thought it was, again, just like the Jordan documentary, really well done. And the way they opened the show, I mean, they come out and tell you, okay, a mature audience only. And I'm thinking, well, okay, there might be an S word here, a D word here. Yeah. And boy, they came out with the big ones right away.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It was just a great scene setter of Lance Armstrong. You know, what's your life like now? And it's basically, he thinks everybody's going to come up to him and just say bleep you to his face. And he has a great story behind that, and how he bought rounds of drinks for everybody that was giving him such a hard time and giving him the middle finger. But I don't want to say I'm sympathetic to him, but I feel like we're getting a clearer version of what happened in his life than we did in Jordan's.
Yeah, you feel like he's – I understand what you're saying, Jim, about it. It appears he's being honest, but when somebody has lied so consistently over the amount of time that he did, I mean, you're talking – year after year after year and ruining people's lives in the process, it's hard to look at him now and go, well, at least we're getting the straight dope now. We're, no pun intended, by the way, but at least we're getting the truth now. And maybe you're getting partial truth, maybe you're getting it all, but that's the problem, is he's just, there is no benefit of the doubt with him. So you tend to look at anything he's saying and say, yeah, there's probably truth to that, but there's probably a lot he's leaving out, is sort of how I view him. But it is, you're right, it's really well done, it's really compelling, and I'm looking forward to part two. It is Tuesday, so it's time to check in with the one, the only El Hombre. Michael Bradley will join us next with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.